Welcome back to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. This is Oliva here with the guys and Dr. Aaron Palmer telling us about witchcraft. Professor Palmer, would you like to tell us anything about yourself?
I'm Aaron Palmer. I'm a professor at Wisconsin Lutheran College. I teach history here. I'm mostly early American Atlantic history, and I've taught this class on witchcraft for about 10 years now.
It's very good to have you with us, Dr. Palmer. Dr. Palmer is also the author of the book A Rule of Law, Elite Political Authority and the Coming of the Revolution in the South Carolina Low Country from 1763 to 1776. He's a treasured colleague, shares an office, well, doesn't share an office. His office is also on the third floor. The historians and the theologians are stuck up here, I suppose, so we don't irritate others. And it's wonderful to have him here in the studio, which is also known as my office. Peter joining us as well. Ben is once again out and about. I believe now he's working the Michigan demographic.
I believe that's
if
right.
If that's correct, yeah. He's up in the Saginaw Bay City Midland area of Michigan, which has been flooding lately. So hopefully he is handing out or tossing sandbags or something while giving pamphlets about the podcast.
Sandbags that say, let the bird fly.
I think that'd be a great idea. We will be sending him back to Iowa soon, but that is why he is not with us today. As we get ready then to discuss witchcraft and sorcery, especially the roles that they've played in history, not so much how to cast spells or anything of that nature, unless Oliva has interest in putting a hex on her sisters or anything, we will get to our disclaimer. Oliva, would you like to bring that again for us this week?
This show does not speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers. To be honest, much of the time, it probably doesn't speak for us. We will be thinking out loud a lot, so approach what you hear with a healthy skepticism. Because, well, as a responsible resident of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you were just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live freely, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
Our scripture narrative today, we have a little bit of a different passage than what we normally have as we're going into the epistles today. We'll be looking at a section from St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians chapter 5, and maybe this is a good place to plug the Galatians devotions that are available on our website, letthebirdfly.com, under devotions. Those are also shared on the Facebook page, and if I'm not mistaken, Peter, people can now subscribe to those or to the blog posts via email. Is that correct?
Yeah, if you go to any of the posts on the actually on the bottom of I think any page, you can subscribe. But on some of the Galatians posts too, there's a place, and you can subscribe to just devotions or blog posts. Eventually, we'll have episodes there too. You can already subscribe to episodes under a different link. But yeah, just trying to figure out how this World Wide Web thing works. So
yeah, and we are hoping to.
I think it's via.
There's a lot of ways it could go. You were just making rules for me today, Oliva. You're taking over for Ailey as our resident legalist. Oliva before was trying to burden my conscience as well. She hasn't learned yet that when a conscience is as numb as mine, it is very hard to burden. I will say with the devotions too, you know, sometimes people get worried about giving their email. What are we going to do with it? And basically all we're going to do with it is probably share it with the Russians, maybe some Nigerians who want to deposit money in your bank account. Anything else we're planning?
I don't think there's anyone else that we're planning on. I mean, who knows though?
Okay.
We will keep your information safe. It will only be used for our purposes to let you know about what's going on and for really what you signed up for.
So. Yeah, and we won't be spamming you all the time with stuff, bombarding you. So think about that. If you find those things helpful, it's a good way to maybe get them in your inbox. And if you've been enjoying them, maybe on a rough day, you get a nice, pleasant surprise. With that in mind, then, we will get into our section from Galatians. And I'm going to read it first and then see if you can figure out what we're getting at, and maybe see if I can figure out what I'm getting at too. This is from Galatians then, chapter 5, beginning with verse 16. Paul writes, "But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other, to keep you from doing the things you want to do. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are evident: sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy," man, this sounds like Peter, "fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. I warn you as I warned you before that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness." That sure sounds like Christ. "Gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. And those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires." And a few things just to bring out in there. Whenever you read a passage like that, and you read those who do, and maybe the Greek there better is, they practice such things, right? This becomes habitual. It becomes part of one's life, a defining feature of their life. Those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. We can get a little bit nervous because, if we're honest, some of those sins listed, even if we haven't committed them outright, and I'm sure there's some we all have, we have certainly also been tempted to them. And so hearing that people who do or practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God rightly does, I would hope, and should strike some terror into us. I've heard a pastor say before, preach the law like everyone's going to hell, preach the gospel like everyone's going to heaven. And maybe you've sat in church and the pastor has let the law do its work and gotten out of the way and let the Spirit convict and accuse and exhort and rebuke, and you've realized this is not good. What then shall we do? How then shall we be saved? And I think this takes us back to an important theme for the Christian life, which goes back to Romans 7. And I've actually had several suggestions that this be an episode, and we'll have to do it at some point. But the simile that we are, simile justus et peccator, we're at the same time a sinner and a saint. So there are things we want to do that we do not do according to the Spirit through the weakness of the flesh. But there's also things according to the flesh that we want to do that through the Spirit's intercession and in Christ dwelling in us, we will refrain from doing by God's grace, by His power, not by our own, not like two oxen pulling a cart, but with Christ taking the lead, and thus us as new men and women seeking, striving to serve Him. And so we have mentioned in there these different sins, and some of them might be easy for us to identify with. I think idolatry, maybe we think we haven't, you know, bowed down and worshipped a wooden or metal statue or anything like that, but I think all of us daily have made idols of ourselves. I think Peter still has statues, many such, around his house, but I believe you call those saints, right, that you're praying to, Peter?
Oh, I thought you meant statues of myself. I've had to slow down on that. They're too expensive to commission any.
You have statues of Mary all over, though, right?
I do.
Yeah, of course.
Well, that's just because it's art, Aliva.
Right. It's not.
We need
like
to
you.
Be able to just. Aliva is just like trying to throw every mad time. Shade at me.
She's trying.
Not like you bow every time you pass them.
I spent 18 years praying to Mary. I got that in enough. So I said enough Hail Marys to last a lifetime, and I've put that in my past.
Still don't think Mary's happy with you.
Probably not. I don't think Jesus is happy with me most of the time either, and he died for me.
It wouldn't surprise me.
But to get to that list, idolatry, dissensions, divisions, envy, these are things that we can identify with. One of them in there that maybe you hear and you think, "Woo, I'm all good." You know, sometimes we do this with the commandments too: "Do not murder." All right, rah rah rah, I've not murdered. But sorcery is mentioned, which can be translated a lot of different ways. I believe here the word in the Greek is the same word we have gotten the English word pharmacy from, if I'm not mistaken, because sorcery was prone to, you know, be concerned with potions and things of this nature. I would think about sorcery if I could get a potion to keep Aliva quiet right now at the moment.
It won't happen.
But you know, sorcery might not be something that's on our radar today as much. I remember living in Madison as a vicar and riding my bike a lot, and there was always on this one park some, what do you call it, Wiccan girls or whatever that would be around a tree, you know, high school girls casting a spell or whatever, and I managed to survive my ride through successfully. But I don't think most of us in our everyday life this is something that we're encountering, but it's something that merits mention in both the Old and the New Testament in different forms. We think of Saul wanting Samuel brought back for him in the Old Testament, for example. But it's something that also just historically has played an important role, and not only religiously, but it's been an intersecting point for politics and culture, village life, you know, the other, the attraction that can be found in that, and things of that nature. And so that's what we'll be looking at today. But as we do, I just want to drive home from Paul's message here in Galatians 5, just how wonderfully he works in both law and gospel here. All of these things that if they become our identity, if we practice them, then we shall not inherit the kingdom of God. But how he comes back to, again, what our identity is and what it is we live by. We don't live by the flesh. We don't live under the curse of the law. As the devotions have been heading on with the earlier portions of Galatians, we now live in the Spirit, in the freedom of the Spirit. And in what has happened to our sinful flesh, it has been crucified with Christ, so that we are now set free, I believe you could maybe say, to live freely in a world given back to us, not to live selfishly, but to be outwardly turned towards our neighbor. And so Paul mentions all of these fruits of the Spirit, and notice how many of them are focused on others or derive their joy from others. And so keeping that in mind, that if we have fallen into these sins or any sort of sin, that we have forgiveness and salvation in Christ, who will then also give us his Spirit that we might live anew, we will press forward into our free-for-all.
And we're back for the free-for-all, where we wrestle with the pressing questions of life. Today we are going back to, I don't know, middle school maybe, and we're asking questions that all start with, would you rather, or at least that's the premise. And so if you have completed middle school successfully, first of all, congratulations. I'll pin a rose on your nose. But also, you should be very familiar with this line of questioning. So to start us off with the barrage, we'll pass it off to Wade.
And I will say, feel free to post or message us on Facebook, but posting on the page could be fun. If you have any thoughts on any of these questions that are raised, it'd be interesting to see what the audience thinks. You can also email us your thoughts at wouldyourather@letthebirdfly.com as well, so that will make its way to us. I have just sheets upon sheets of these, and I've tried to highlight a few that I think might be interesting, and so I'll toss them out and we'll see what happens with them. But the first one, I think, I'm curious if we would get the same answers that we get tonight if I asked in a different season of the year. And so the first one I have is, would you rather live in a place where it is always hot or always cold?
Aliva's quickly hopping up here, so go ahead.
Always hot.
Why, Aliva?
Because you can't do things when it's snowing. You can't. You have to get all bundled up, and then you can't do anything.
Can you ski?
Well, I can't personally, so no.
Can you have a snowball fight?
Who does that anymore?
Can you sled?
I don't think we have any.
Can you build a snowman?
No.
Do you want to build a snowman?
Don't even start.
The Dr. Promo is all right if I call you Aaron for purposes of the podcast.
Yes.
Aaron or Peter, any thoughts on that?
I say cold, but, you know, I have allergies, so everything dies in the winter. It's great. You can do lots of things in the winter. We go mountain climbing every January in Tennessee. You know,
really? I knew you went down there. I didn't know you were mountain climbing.
Well, but
I
know you don't climbing. Feel as trapped up in all your gear.
You're just afraid to go out, Aliva. It seems to be.
Oh yeah, right.
I share your allergies, so I can appreciate that aspect. Peter, what about you? You've been in extreme heat in Texas.
Yeah, it wasn't terribly extreme. We were North Texas, but I prefer the cold. I actually prefer winter activities. I like going out and, you know, skiing and skating. And
you've never taken me skiing. Well, that's you like it so much.
We don't have skis. Well, I grew up cross-country skiing, but my parents loved me more than yours love you, so that might explain
why.
No, but the other reason I always say is I have allergies as well, seasonal allergies that are just awful. The real problem is I sweat as soon as I look at anything over like 50 degrees, and so I walk around soaked all summer long, and I always say, well, it's only decent to take off so many clothes, but I can always put more layers on. So the cold, you know, I can handle that a lot better.
I've thought of that like a lot, but I don't have allergies, and I what was I going to say? Oh yeah, and I don't sweat very easily, so.
I have to imagine you burn, though, Aliva, with being so blonde and fair-skinned. You must get easily red.
Of course
in the summer.
I burn. I get really tan. So my mom teases me because
I have... Well, tan is different than burning.
Well, I burn still. I have a farmer's tan, though, so my mom makes fun of me.
Yeah, well, it makes it look like you actually do some work. I'm sure that's not the case, but at least it gives that impression.
Only fat guys don't work.
Hey, in defense of fat guys.
I don't know. You better be careful. You're in a room of three fat guys.
I will say I have to somewhat give a disclaimer for my answer. I'm answering it with Midwestern heat in mind. So I'm going to go, I'd rather have it be hot all the time. But not if it's like Florida, muggy, giant insect, snake, like any of that kind of heat. I will go with Midwestern heat, but I'm guessing that I probably can't do that without Midwestern winters. But if I could take Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota summers, I'd probably take that just for the outside sports and the things we're able to do. But if it had to be Florida, you know, Texas, just shoot me now heat, I think I would probably take the winters in the Midwest. Aliva, did you have a thought? I kind of cut you off there. You had, like, something you were going to interject.
Well, I didn't say humid, I want to point out.
Yeah, and I think that does make a big difference when you think about it. The humidity can just kill you, and we get some of that, but I have been where it's hot, and I'll take 80 degrees up here all year round just fine. But I do have allergies, and I gotta bite the bullet on that one. We have a, let me see. Here's one. We have two historians in the room, one who gets to teach in his field, and one who teaches theology. And so we'll see what the thoughts we might have here. We also have an amateur philosopher who has surely thought about this a lot, and Aliva, who is just ready with an answer today, so we'll see. Would you rather be famous when you are alive and forgotten when you die, or unknown when you are alive, but famous after you die?
I don't know what good being famous when you're dead is. You think of someone like Herman Melville. Everybody knows who Herman Melville is. He was a nobody when he was alive. He was a total failure. Nobody read Moby Dick until like the 1930s, and they rediscovered it. It didn't do him any good. I don't know how that would help you.
See, I'm somewhat drawn to the famous after you die, but only from the standpoint of probably so many of the people that we've studied are people who were not famous in their own day, but they're known for something that comes to light later. But I have to admit, that's probably not a very good reason, because the actual personal benefits are not great. And knowing that I'd probably have no cognizance, you know, Melville isn't aware that everybody knows who he is now, that might be a negative. Although I have to say, I think I would not handle fame well in this life. And so probably for my own health and not being a jerk to people, and maybe it would be better for me to delay it if I ever were going to have it. I mean, I have a bunch of just paintings and writings that I've scrolled away somewhere to be discovered after I go. We'll see what happens with that.
Is that your humility that drives you to just hide everything that you
exactly
that you create?
My modesty. Aliva, you have any thoughts on this?
I'd say on the one hand, if you're famous when you're alive, then you can get rich and stuff. But if you're famous once you're dead, then more people know about you.
So you want the riches. You want these skis now, don't you?
No, I don't want skis.
What would you do if you were rich, Aliva? What's the first thing you would do?
Buy your parents.
No, don't even start.
You know what I would do? I would tithe. I would give to the church, and I would give more than 10% because that's minimum love for Jesus. I'd probably give like 11%.
I think Pastor Johnston's 11. A real Christian.
I can beat you. I'd give 50%.
Well, actually, since I go to the same church, I'm in favor of this, and I think we can get new bathrooms on the main floor now, possibly, too, as well as air conditioning. I would love to have some air conditioning. So I am now hoping that you get rich. Peter, did you have any thoughts on this?
No, I guess, you know, I have thought about this, and I remember, I think it was
Kierkegaard writing a pseudonym.
Yes.
Famous later.
No, I thought about this, it was early in high school, maybe even middle school, but I told my history teacher, you know, I want to do something so I can be in one of these books someday. And he kind of laughed at me and said, well, good luck. You know, so it is something that I guess I've thought about.
Hitler did that.
I
think you have to.
I started looking for the easiest route and started realizing that.
Genocide.
A lot of people are in those books for the wrong reasons.
No, I think I guess I would have to say, you know, during life, just because, you know, like Aaron said, you can't really enjoy it after you die anyway. So, but it seems like there are a lot of people that I certainly respect that no one really knew of before they died. So,
but if you're famous after you die, then you know that you've done something good during your life.
Maybe. Well, you know it. Do you care?
Probably not.
I don't know.
I have one last one here, and then we'll make our way into the main topic. And this one I think is interesting for me to think about. Would you rather go to jail for 4 years for something you didn't do or get away with something horrible you did but always live in fear of being caught? Conscience.
Mm-hmm. I'd rather go to jail for 4 years not without having to do something. But, like, with being innocent.
She likes to fancy herself a martyr, I guess. So, no, it's hard. It depends on how horrible it is. You know, the things that kind of eat at you. I just can't imagine, like, you know the guilt, but then also always looking over your shoulder. Oh, are they going to catch me? Are they going to catch me? Right. So that would be kind of rough. But I don't know. Jail doesn't sound fun. I mean, I don't have any personal experience with it, but uh-huh. I guess I kind of like to keep it that way.
What if you're a sociopath and you have no fear of being caught or no conscience?
Well, then I think, of, you know, might as well get away with it, right?
And yeah. He'd probably be in the history books.
That's true. Yeah, I'll work on this.
Dr. Palmer, any thoughts on this?
I think I wouldn't do well in prison, so I'd have to go with the living with the guilt.
Yeah, I also think I would not do well in jail. And as someone who's been in jail a lot to visit people in the ministry, and actually ministered, had a lot of members who were guards in jails or prisons. That's only enhanced my realization that it's no place for me. And the law then works really well as a curb in that regard. But I don't know. I think I might have to side with Aliva on this, that I am already paranoid as it is that I'm going to get in trouble. Like, for something I didn't even do. You know, if I see a policeman on the road, I'm just waiting for them to turn around and put their lights on and pull me over. And so I think I would go absolutely crazy, always worrying about if anybody's going to find out or what's going to happen if it gets out and I were caught and things of that nature. So I think I'd almost rather have the 4 years of knowing I'm innocent and hopefully being protected by a really devout, religious, caring cellmate who appreciates my training historically and I don't know. But I think I would go insane worrying about being caught if that were hanging over my head.
As none of us like either ideas, what if we just don't do either of them?
Well, see, Oliva's going into sixth grade this year, so she's technically not in middle school yet. She's just on the cusp, so she doesn't understand the premise of.
I've already graduated
from fifth
grade.
Yeah, you have to do one or the other. You don't. You can't be an in between on this.
I already decided for the question.
Yeah, but
I'm just
gonna,
saying. In
well,
real
I
life,
can. I can help you go to jail for something you didn't do. I can come up with fake charges.
And I can come up with fake charges for you.
Ooh.
Except that they'd probably be real.
Yeah, it could be. You just have to realize, hon, I grew up in Michigan in the Detroit area, and I think I can out-deny you on about anything.
And I grew
I don't
up
admit
in Fort
nothing
Worth, Texas.
Until it can be proven beyond That's a shadow right. of a doubt. And I'm happy to say both my boys have inherited that, too. We really have to separate them, interrogate them, and say that the other is snitched and make threats before they'll give anything up either. So
I'm a good debater. Just ask my dad.
Just ask your dad.
He'll tell you.
She's relentless.
You should be a defense attorney like Jesus.
I'm going to be a coder.
He's probably a more honest one. You're going to be a what?
A computer science person.
Oh, I thought you said a coroner. I was like...
Coder.
Coder. Okay.
Coroner?
I was like, why would you want to be a coroner?
Sounds corny.
Well, although where my wife is from, you can run for coroner. They have signs to get elected for coroner. And I've always joked that eventually I am going to run for a Dodge County coroner or whatever the village is, just so I can have the title. And I don't know. I mean, it seems like a pretty easy job. You kind of show up and poke someone a little bit and say... sorry, you know, but I don't know. I don't know who you get, if you have to have a party affiliation for that, how you raise money for the signs, if there's, you know, a lot of fundraising that has to go on or what.
Run into trouble for campaign finance law infractions, and then you just wanted to be a coroner, right?
Yeah, that's
and
all I ever
you find
wanted.
Yourself in jail for
just
4 years.
Just think of the campaign slogans, though, that you could have. It'd be pretty fun. And you could probably just declare people dead for fun, even though they're not. Just file it. You get mad at someone. And imagine the phone calls they'd have to make with their credit card companies and stuff like this. Who knows? All right, well, we better get to our main topic of the day. And with that, we will make our way there. And that brings us to our main topic for the day, although we were very interested in his takes for Would You Rather, we invited Dr. Palmer with us today to talk once again about the witchcraft or sorcery and its role, especially historically, and things of that nature. Just to plug once more, he does have a book out for those interested in history, especially American colonial history, A Rule of Law, Elite Political Authority, and the Coming of the Revolution in the South Carolina Lowcountry, from 1763 to 76. But by way of background, just to repeat it, he does teach a course here at the college on witchcraft. And maybe the easiest way for us to get started would be if you could just outline for us, Dr. Palmer, how the course is constructed, kind of just the chronology of it, how it flows through the semester.
Well, we start out just with an introduction generally to a Christian perspective on the occult and witchcraft in general. I think that's important to lay out some of the theology that we as Lutherans and Christians believe regarding this, because it naturally is going to come up. And I always begin the class saying no one will learn how to become a witch in the class. Oh, I did have someone who claimed to be a witch, nice.
Wiccan. How many drops do you get after you explain no one will learn how to become a witch?
Usually 50%. You know, it's usually not an issue. When I started offering the course, there were some eyebrows raised, but I think most people realize we're talking about the history of witchcraft here. It's a course called Witchcraft and Culture in the Atlantic World. So we start out in Europe, look at the witch hunts that really are in the early modern period, 1500 through about 1700. Then we move into some areas in the Atlantic, so... Latin America, we look at the Aztecs, for example, African-American cultures, sort of how do European beliefs merge with some of these other beliefs that have their own occult practices. And then Salem is the case study. There's an enormous amount of records, so the students will go through the court records concerning one of the people who was executed for witchcraft at Salem and try to reconstruct what happened to this person. How did they end up on the gallows, essentially? So it's really a seminar course. It's a lot of discussion and then presenting and discussing research.
Very interesting. And one of the things you mentioned that makes my ears perk up and my mind is going a little bit back to colloquiums and seminars in grad school. But it is interesting. You mentioned in the early modern period there's witch hunts that pop up. And I think, well, I even mentioned to you before we were recording, I think a lot of people, if they're thinking periodization, might think these are things that happen in the Middle Ages, right? You know, people are all superstitious, things of this nature. But it's actually as the West is beginning to come out of what people call the Middle Ages, and if we had a medieval historian here, if Dr. Leninger was down here, he might object to that term Middle Ages even. But it's in the early modern period where people in the West, at least now, think of this as this time of we're getting ready for the Enlightenment, we're getting ready to press forward. Why this, if, and there might not be a clear answer, why this outburst of witch hunts in that period?
It's a matter of a lot of debate. No one is really sure, and it's not everywhere. There's one witch hunt in England, and there's a couple of things in New England, but for the most part, you're talking about France, Spain, and Germany are the real hotbeds of all this, a little bit in Eastern Europe. Some people would argue that the Reformation was part of it, and then the Counter-Reformation. So, for example, in Italy, we will see the Inquisition. It does not exist to deal with witchcraft. It exists to deal with heresy, but to the extent that witchcraft is heresy, it'll deal with those things as well. There's also an increasing divide between intellectual culture, elite culture, and popular culture. And that's one of the most fun things about studying witchcraft is you get to see just how weird people really were in the early modern period and what they really believed. It's
good,
really hard to say.
We've moved beyond that in our day.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's it's a tough thing. Salem, for example, is 1692 and 93. So you're thinking this is, what, 150 years after Luther's dead? You know, it's relatively recent. The Age of the Enlightenment, this is after Newton, has already begun. But, you know, you have to understand the culture in which these things occur, I think, more than anything else. It's not medieval, that's for sure.
And that's maybe a helpful reminder for our own day. As someone who's personally has done intellectual history, one of the knocks against intellectual history that has been made by cultural and social historians, and I think a fair knock, although perhaps at the same time we've begun to undervalue intellectual history, is that a lot of times we think these ideas happen and big thinkers think these ideas and then we just assume everybody's like, oh, these ideas are great and we all think these ideas. And we don't necessarily understand how it trickled down throughout culture and society. Even with the Reformation, we know theologically these new things are being preached, but one of the fun things to look at is to what extent are they taking hold among the lay people. I think maybe this is helpful in our own day too, because we oftentimes will talk about intellectual movements or things of this nature, and you can then look and weigh, well, to what extent has it made its way down? And it does make its way down. You look at postmodernity or things of this nature, and you see it trickle down into the culture. But not everything that's being, you know, even today, sometimes here in academia, people, you know, are teaching and thinking this, and then it's assumed, well, now everybody's thinking this. And we see that's not necessarily the case when polls are taken. And I think, you know, 2016 made clear just how differently many people are thinking on various sides of things. When you mentioned then France and Spain and Germany, France and Spain, I'm guessing, you know, this is partly because of the Inquisition, but more Roman Catholic. In Germany, we have a divide, Protestant, Roman Catholic. Do you think these are taking place more in Protestant areas of Germany, more in Roman Catholic, or it's really kind of hard to say?
It's all over, really. I mean, you see a lot of it during and after the 30 Years' War, especially. If you know von Grimmelhausen, one of the first novels, if you want to even call it that, is really he's telling the story of a mercenary wandering through Germany in the 30 Years' War. He gets into witchcraft in there. I think you tend to see outbreaks of this in societies under great strain. If you look at Salem, you're going to see all kinds of strain. And this is a period of constant warfare throughout Europe. It's really an awful period. If you were going to pick a period to be alive, this would not be it. The average lifespan is about 25 for most people.
So we're all dead except Aliva.
Yay!
She gets to run the podcast.
But to be fair, you probably already have diseases that have greatly weakened your body. And you're about to probably have like 8 kids and 4 of them die. And then you'll probably die giving birth to the 9th. So
I'm liking living in 2017.
You mentioned the intense pressure then. What Are these things, as they're breaking out, in Europe at least, maybe if we begin there for now, that these hunts, these trials, are they being led by the clergy or by the church? Or are these breaking out, are these popular things that are breaking out that then in some instances maybe are influenced by the church, others that are not? I know even sometimes with Inquisition you have the church pulling back the reins and saying, whoa, 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 let's hold up on this. The church is not always the cheerleader for this, although, you know, sometimes it is. What tends to be, how you know, this breaks out in a village or a town, is this oftentimes the priest is pushing it or things of this nature? Or the Lutheran pastor?
It depends where you are. You know, if you're in England, it's almost always local. And there you don't have organized witch hunts. It is not the clergy who are doing it. It's the courts. And it's usually brought by individuals who know each other. In Europe, it really depends. In Germany, for example, there were these two inquisitors, Kramer and Sprenger, who wrote what's called the Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of the Witches.
Which is,
it was
if
a manual.
I remember from grad school now, very important. Or very... There's a number of scholars very interested in this book.
Yeah, it's a bizarre book, but it's a manual for how to hunt witches. And there you do have inquisitors for this region, clergy, officials, kind of directing this thing. But witches, if they're going to be tried and executed, this has to be done almost always through a secular court somewhere. So you're not seeing – this isn't a persecution being led by the church. This is something that happens through the mechanisms of justice, essentially.
And so here we see one of those intersections you're mentioning between church and state are political, ecclesiastical, cultural, economic, I'm sure, things as well. Do the and we'll move to Salem in a moment. When these are breaking out, what seems to be the – you've mentioned the tension in society – do they tend to spring from interpersonal grudges or, I am upset with my neighbor and I know this is an easy thing to accuse it from? Does it tend to come from unexplained things happening in the community? I'm thinking the pogroms, you know, in Europe, for instance, the plague comes and the Jews live outside the city and they're keeping the Old Testament ceremonial washing laws and they're living a different life. And so they're not dying at the same rate from the plague. And so it's assumed, well, they must be poisoning the wells, which is obviously foolishness. But at that time, it maybe made sense. Is it usually to maybe explain away some of the suffering that's come? Is there one most common way that these develop?
A lot of it tends to be a way that an uneducated person in this period can explain the unexplainable. So, for example, you're a farmer and you have a cow.
So it's the early modern equivalent of Putin.
Yes. Blame everything on the Russians, right?
Sorry, go ahead.
So you're a farmer who has a cow, and one day the cow doesn't give you milk, it gives you blood. Well, you know, today I think you'd have a very sick cow and you better get to a veterinarian. But in the early modern period, that is hard to explain, especially if it comes on suddenly and inexplicably. Now, maybe 3 days earlier, a beggar came to your door and you said, "Get out of here, you rotten bum. I'm not giving you anything." And as she walks away, it's usually a she in these cases, she's muttering something. Well, now your cow is sick. Well, that must be a witch. She must have cursed your cow. That's how life works. So very commonly, unexplained misfortune is where these things start. And it's usually between people who know each other. So neighbors who quarrel, the local beggar, the oddball in the community, something like that. Some people can make themselves targets, too, to be sure. You know, you have some people who have, even for this period, strange beliefs and... for whatever reason, won't keep their mouths shut about them.
Aliva. Sorry, go ahead.
I thought that was you.
Yeah, the...
Now, these strange non-Christian beliefs or just superstitious beliefs intermingled with kind of syncretistic beliefs?
Exactly. There's a historian, Carlo Ginzburg, who spent his whole career looking at the records of the Roman Inquisition, and he found some really bizarre things. There was a group of people in northern Italy who... seemed to believe that at night, during certain times of the year, they left their bodies, assumed the form of animals, and did combat with witches who also assumed the form of animals. Huh. And the Inquisition didn't know what to make of this. They were accused of witchcraft, and these people kept telling them, we're not witches, we're the good guys, we fight for Jesus. And the Inquisition kept, no, you don't. You know, they just would not stop talking about this, and that got them into trouble. It was a kind of agrarian cult of sorts in
and
northern
Italy.
And
in this case, Italy. You think, would this sometimes play in with mental illness then maybe too if someone, not necessarily mental illness like depression, something of this, but psychosis or something of that nature?
I think a lot. I mean, a related phenomenon is demonic possession, which of course is real. I mean, the Bible certainly talks about it, but you know, what are you going to think if you are, you know, your average, uneducated, illiterate mother in Germany in 1540 and your daughter has an epileptic fit? That can be terrifying, even today.
Yeah.
You're going to assume, probably, this is something supernatural, something evil. So I think we just have to understand that in that world, most people knew so little about how the world worked, how their bodies worked. Of course the temptation is to turn to something else then that seems explainable.
Well, and I think, you know, it's a particular bias of our age maybe, and I think people really struggle with this psychologically and spiritually, that we almost assume, well, yeah, there's an explanation for everything. Or with medical phenomenon, of course, the doctors can fix it. And when they can't, or when they try something and it doesn't work, they can be shocked. You know, they forget that a doctor in many ways is like the car mechanic. Maybe it's this. We'll try this. And but even in our own day, you still have people who will buy or spend their life marketing, selling rather ridiculous things that are going to help with various health aspects. You know, I think of the woman in the New Testament who has unclean flow of blood, whatever. She goes to Jesus and it says she had spent all her money on physicians. I think there's plenty in our own day who have spent all their money on, you know, hoping to have something fixed that necessarily isn't sure too. But even Luther, it's interesting. You mentioned that. It reminds me, working with Luther, I've stumbled upon places where he'll talk about Wechselbach or changelings. And it seems, you know, Luther had this belief that the devil could impregnate a woman. Sometimes people at that time thought, like, if a woman went in the water above her waist or things of this nature, or the devil could come steal a baby and leave a baby. And usually it had a bigger-than-normal head and screamed a lot, and which could be some illness or something it was suffering.
I've had one or two of those.
Yeah. And but, you know, it just... And this was considered to be an acceptable explanation. It doesn't mean it was right. But, yeah, in our own day, too, we can have all sorts of, you know, we want to understand things. And, you know, I guess I myself can be a conspiracy theorist pretty easily sometimes, too.
I heard a historian and historian.
I just say it both ways because I'm never sure.
You know, okay, well, if you...
Dr. Palmer, do you have an answer to this?
I have no preference.
I have a friend who was from, like, the New York area. He always said an. No, he said, no, he dropped off the H. He said historian. But anyway, I'll say an historian. I heard an historian say recently one of the...
I believe it's a historian.
A historian, okay, I'll go with that. one of the biggest... biggest things that frustrates him and biggest mistakes that he thinks people generally make is we don't look at the events that are going on within the time period. We look at it right now with 2017 eyes, and we kind of, you know, interpret it in that way then. Like, well, how could they think this? How could they do that? And so he was really encouraging the listeners to, you know, think about the context. You have to put it in context. Otherwise, you can't even begin to understand it. So it seems like that certainly would be helpful in this regard.
Well, one thing I warn students about, too, is, you know, we read some of these stories, and they just seem totally ludicrous. How could you people believe that? Well, they did. And that's the thing that's even more shocking. You know, you look at Salem, 19 people are executed for a crime, a capital felony that's on the books called witchcraft and devil worship. Well, they're executed because people believed sincerely in these things. And, you know, we have to be a little careful too as Christians in dismissing all of this, because we certainly believe in the devil. There are some Christians who don't, and you're going down a really dangerous road if you start down that path. But there's a separation between theology and superstition that most people just don't make. And as you were pointing out, even Luther, I mean, he's a person of his time, is prone to a lot of the kind of folk beliefs of the period.
And I think it's a helpful reminder, too, that people tend to act on belief and conviction. I think we sometimes take that for granted. I remember in grad school being in colloquiums and seminars, and everything always had to have an economic explanation, you know, class struggle, things of this nature. But even when it comes to class struggle, things of this nature, we think of many of the terrible crimes perpetrated by Marxists. And I know people get upset when you say that because only religious people can perpetrate atrocities, and religious people can and have. That's certainly true. But they did so with maybe it wasn't a theological belief relating to a deity, but it was definitely with a belief and conviction regarding a path of history and a better future, and dare we say even a heaven, although it was here on earth. And I think it can be helpful, as was mentioned, to not negate that people are creatures who believe things. Even the atheist or the most secular person still believes things. And this always, with students, I'll ask them sometimes when we're getting started with philosophy, does everybody have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? And they'll say yes, and I'll say, okay, prove it. Right? That's a belief. That is something, a conviction that we have. And then when we look at history and philosophers to remember, well, maybe they didn't share a belief or conviction on that. You know, we get to Nietzsche, and Nietzsche obviously has some different things that he's going to take for granted. But I would agree, we can tend to look at these things and minimize. If you read the Gospels, and you know, Mark, the best gospel, is constantly dealing with demon possession and a very active devil. And sometimes we can forget that for the Christian, the devil is as real as God. You know, this is not I'm not equating the two in some Manichaean way. But this is...
So wait, there's good and there's evil, and then they're equal, right? And they battle it out.
Exactly, Star Wars. But I mean, you can't have a Jesus who didn't cast out demons.
So is the good or the evil going to win?
I'm waiting to find out.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, or a Jesus who didn't descend into hell. These are part of the earthly Jesus, the God-made man Jesus, life and ministry. So with that, maybe if we can make our way to Salem. So we've made our way to America, USA, and...
well, not quite.
Yeah.
Not quite, actually. America, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that we should be able to claim all of history for America.
Manifest destiny.
From sea to signing sea, from beginning to end. Right. We make our way to what will become the USA. And we have, first, to maybe understand the situation of Salem, whether it be political, religious, social. What's helpful that you want your students to know, or just for the listener right now to understand about Salem as a place in that time?
Well, it's a fairly typical Puritan community in Massachusetts. It was a growing area. There were two Salems, actually. There was Salem Town, which was the oldest community in Massachusetts. And there was this other place called Salem Village. It's sort of like Milwaukee and New Berlin, essentially, or, you know, whatever a suburb of Detroit might be.
We'll go with Livonia, my hometown.
There you go. You know, Salem Village was a newer area being settled. There were tensions between the Salem Village and Salem Town. It was one of the most contentious places I think you can possibly imagine. There were three ministers of Salem Village. Two of them were run out, and the third one eventually presides over the witchcraft crisis and had a very large role in precipitating it. It was a community divided by wealth and social status, huge religious divisions at the time. If you know anything about Puritanism, you know, it's tough to join a Puritan church. You have to make a public confession of faith and give a conversion narrative. Well, that's hard. So to get more members, some Puritans were going with what they called the halfway covenant. So you didn't have to do that.
This
public...
This immediately sounds more attractive to me.
Yes. You know, you don't have to do a public confession, a public narrative, but you can't take communion and you can't have your children baptized. Now, if you're a Calvinist, I don't know why that matters anyway, but, you know, there were limits. So there's all kinds of divisions in this community. It's like a perfect storm for this kind of outbreak to happen, especially when you look at Puritan beliefs of the devil and the occult and all these different things.
So then we have familial, social, cultural, economic, religious, political division within the town, and so a tension point as you mentioned. There's not a, a war going on, I'm guessing, that's influencing this, but is there?
There is, actually.
Okay.
There's several.
and maybe that and just, I mean, economically, are things tight at this period? Or what are the outside pressures that might be factoring in?
Well, there's kind of three things. You have the bloodiest war in American history called King Philip's War. Now, by that I mean per capita, so compared to the population of the time and the number of casualties, it was the bloodiest war in history.
I want to preface that I did not do American history. And I have to admit, I've never heard of King Philip's War. If I have heard about it, I forgot about it. So this is very interesting to me.
It was an attempt by the New England Indians to wipe out every last man, woman, and child, white man, woman, and child in New England. And they came very close to doing it.
And King Philip was a Native American king, correct?
Yeah, his real name was Metacom.
Yeah.
He took the name Philip for a time as a white name, but we usually refer to him as Metacom at this point. So that happened in 1675 and 6, but during the Salem crisis, or just at the end of it, or the beginning of it anyway, was called King William's War, as in William III of England. That's really a global war that was in Europe called the 9 Years' War of the War of the League of Augsburg. In America, it's a war between French Canada and their Indian allies, and New England and New York and their Indian allies, and they're just, again, a really nasty, brutal affair, especially in Maine. And a lot of the families in Salem seem to have had ties to people who had participated in that war. So you had that trauma going on. Just a few years earlier, you had a political crisis in all of northern colonial America. Without getting into the details, let's just say that the Puritans lost control of the colony. And it was now a royal colony under King William III. And they're in a bit of limbo, so you have that going on. Economically, generally, this is not a good time, the end of the 17th century. So there are, again, so many different pressures going on. Historians like to try to pick out which one is most important. The wisest path, I think, is it's a confluence of all of these things creating a massive crisis atmosphere that just needed some spark to light it off.
Huh. And now this was before coexist bumper stickers, which might have helped with all of this, huh?
Well, that may have, prevented the tragedy.
I think it is fascinating. You mentioned, a confluence of things. And I think even in the period of history I study, it almost always is, right? Sometimes we like to say it's one thing. And even still today we like to say, pinpoint politics, things of this nature, this one thing. But I think oftentimes it is. A person doesn't live in a vacuum. They're experiencing a multitude of things, and they might fixate on certain. But that makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of stuff going on. Something has to spark it. What sets it off?
Well, it's in the spring, I believe, of 1692. The minister at Salem is called Samuel Parris, and he's really a kind of a nasty character. He was a slave owner who had lived in Barbados. He is actually not ordained. He had studied for a while at Harvard. Let's just say Salem Village was not a desirable posting, so this is who they got.
Huh.
He was constantly at odds with his parishioners over things like his salary. He vocally denounced the halfway covenant, which also irritated a lot of people in the village. He just is not a good minister. Whatever the case, and we don't know why. This is the biggest mystery about Salem. He has two girls living with him. One is his daughter, Betty Parris, and the other is his niece, Abigail Williams. They are 9 and 11, respectively. And for whatever reason, they fell ill. And the symptoms were just described are bizarre. They were called fits, what were commonly called fits. So seizures, the inability to sleep at times, rambling, screaming, shrieking, pain. It would have been, I think, if you're a parent and this happens to your child, something like this, it would be utterly terrifying. Now imagine that in a world without medical science. So Parris goes, of course, to what passes for a doctor in this period, and The doctors tell him, well, we don't know what this is. And the town doctor is supposed to have said, I think there is a, quote, evil hand at work.
Huh.
That meant one of two things. The girls are possessed, meaning the devil is directly at work, or there's a witch, the devil's agent, attacking. Now, the latter is the better explanation because you can do something about it.
Sure, and that's always attractive.
Well, and that's where you start to get into, okay, well, there's a witch. Well, who is it? How do you find a witch? Well, there's ways. It's white magic. Now, the ministers wouldn't have liked this, but the story is that someone in the community, I forget exactly who, because other children started to fall ill as well, went to the slave of Samuel Parris. Her name is Tituba. She was a West Indian Indian, as in Native American. And she made what's called a witch cake. So she baked, and this is disgusting, but she baked the urine of one of the afflicted girls into a cake. And the idea was that if we can just, you know, get the witch near this or have her eat it or something like that, we'll know who it is. There's all kinds of things you can do to try to identify a witch.
When is, Aliva, just out of curiosity, when is your birthday?
No way.
Sorry. So if we can get the witch near this, we can perhaps discern who it is.
Yeah, and it doesn't really make any sense. And some people dispute whether Tituba even made this. But whatever the case, Tituba as a slave is very vulnerable here. She's in the household. She is someone who very likely would have held some strange beliefs, a syncretistic kind of thing. And at some point, she became the subject of questioning in this. Maybe it was because she made the witch cake.
So she can't win either way. It's
no, and there's also there's a legend, and there's debate about whether this is true, that right before the girls fell ill, that they had gone to Tituba to have her tell them their fortune. So you would, I don't know how this works, but you break an egg in a glass and you look in it and somehow it's supposed to tell you who you're going to marry someday. You know, the kind of goofy magic you do when you're a kid. So some people will point to that. Whatever the case, Tituba is questioned. There's several others who are going to be questioned. The girls eventually start to name names. And they named the most obvious people in the community, the weirdos, the people no one's going to like, Sarah Good, Sarah Osborne, and Tituba. It gets out of hand when Tituba is questioned because, you know, she's a slave. It's very likely that Samuel Parris beat her and tried to beat a confession out of her. Slaves, when they're whipped and when they're punished, will confess to anything to get it to stop. Well, I think children do that too.
Understandable, yeah.
Well, she confessed, and then she started naming names. She said, well, I'm not the only one. There's all kinds of witches. There might be 20 of them. And we meet at the and at night, and we have seen people from Boston, and we worship the devil, and I've signed my name in his book. So now you've gone from having a few sick girls in one household to having a secret society of devil-worshipping, malefic witches attacking the community.
Now, I have to understand a little bit. I'm guessing the families of the accused, for the most part, and maybe this is me reading back into it, would have been supportive of denying these charges, or is this something that kind of everybody's so panicked about, even when it's someone in their own household now, that they are, they honestly believe maybe it's possible that this is, you know, that their child or their whatever is participating in this?
Yeah, it gets out of control really quickly. When you have a community that's already so tense, when there's a sense in Puritanism in general at this time that, you know, this was supposed to be the city on a hill. This was supposed to be God's holy place.
And that had to wait for Reagan.
Well,
I'm just joking. Go ahead.
No, I think it had to wait for Trump. But anyway, you know, and what had happened? This hadn't worked. You have wars, you have economic decline, you have all these problems, and now the devil's shown up. But now you have something to assault, witches, the devil's minions. You can get them out. And maybe if you get them out, you can save the whole thing. I think there's some of that mentality here. In any case, you know, there's examples even where people go from being accused of witchcraft to being accusers. Hmm. So this, it gets to the point where you have probably around 150 people sitting in jail. You have
how many people do we think are living in the village or town at this?
Maybe 1,000.
So we're at 10% or more of the community is accused at some point.
And it's not just Salem. This spreads throughout a good portion of Massachusetts, and it really becomes more of a regional thing. But you know, by the time you're done, you have 19 people executed. One of them was this woman called Rebecca Nurse. She's almost 80. She had a perfect, sterling reputation. Everybody loved Rebecca Nurse, except apparently some of her neighbors. Because she was accused, and, you know, the problem is what's evidence in a court, right? When you go to this court, there's no presumption of innocence, and the evidence is what they call spectral evidence. So you'd walk into a courtroom, and here are these afflicted girls. Not all girls. Some of them were men, actually. But they were there, and they would kind of, almost on command, just fall into fits.
So spectral, meaning you see it, it's performed, or?
Yeah. So Rebecca Nurse walks into the courtroom, and the judges will ask her, well, why do you afflict these girls? It's not an not a question of do you, it's why do you? So I don't know what you're talking about. And then the girls fall into fits. I see the specter of Rebecca Nurse. She's tearing at me. She's clawing me. She's pulling out my eyes. You know, and it in that kind of atmosphere, that circus sort of atmosphere, it was taken seriously. So Salem is one of those things, again, I am convinced there was no one who was accused of witchcraft at Salem was practicing anything remotely like witchcraft or magic. This is a case of horrendous misjustice, which is why I think it serves as a great metaphor. It's why Arthur Miller wrote about it in the context of McCarthyism in the 1950s.
I was just going to take it there. Maybe we're not accusing people of witchcraft anymore, but I think that's still a tool probably societally that we find helpful, huh? To label some group as the problem group, whether for the fascists it was some minority group, whether for Marxists it is some class group or the kulaks or whatever the case may be in the Soviet Union. And I think religion has done its fair share of this as well. But definitely, you know, seems like this wasn't just all superstition, that there's a number of factors of otherness that are involved. What do they just tire themselves out with this, or what kind of brings it down to a fizzle and an end?
Well, I think when the first executions happen, they're done in groups. I think all of a sudden it's real.
And these are hangings, or?
Yeah, these were all hangings. No one was actually burned or anything like that at Salem. But, you know, the first group were the ones who were easy. Bridget Bishop, for example, had already been accused of witchcraft once before and had been acquitted. Sarah Good was this terribly contentious person that nobody liked. It was easy to discount them. Second group was harder. There you had Rebecca Nurse. You had George Burroughs, who was the former minister of Salem, accused of being the ringleader of the witches.
He must have preached too long, huh?
He was actually accused of killing several people, so he wasn't exactly the most sterling person. But right before he's hung, he performed very well. He said the Lord's Prayer. You're not supposed to be able to do that if you're a witch. I think the way that second group died, how so many people were being accused, it eventually got to the point where there was talk that the governor's wife was a witch. And finally, it was the ministers, mostly in Boston, who stood up and said, enough's enough. This idea of spectral evidence just doesn't fly. And they didn't doubt that there could be witches, but what the minister said is, well, maybe what's really happening here is that the devil is using the specters of other people to turn us against each other. And, you know, if you want to take a religious point of view on Salem, I think that's a very good point of view to take. I mean, forget about the spectral thing, but, I mean, this is how the devil works. He divides. He turns people against each other. That's what happens at Salem. So ultimately, they remove spectral evidence as admissible in court. And once that happens, no one is convicted, and it goes away.
Hmm.
That reminds me of C.S. Lewis's book, Screwtape Letters, where they have the conversation between the devils, and the older devil is telling his nephew, "No, no, if they're not going to church, if they're messing things up, leave them alone, right?" Yeah. So, I mean, if they're on their literal witch hunt here, well, we don't need to get involved.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the devil didn't really need to have witches in Salem. He just needed sinners, and they did plenty of damage. That's one thing you see in Salem, too, is just how you see fallen man at his worst, really, in every way. At the end of it all, it is the last, as far as I know, the last time that anyone was charged with witchcraft in America. It is certainly not the end of people believing in witches. But it does kind of represent some turning point in terms of the law. This just does not happen again.
And that was going to be my next question, if this is kind of the tail end of it. Is the same true in Europe? Has it kind of ceased being something people are tried for in Europe at this time, too? Or were the Europeans ahead of us with that, or they linger a little bit longer?
In Eastern Europe, it goes into the 18th century. In Germany, Western Europe, it pretty much dies out by the end of the 17th century. A lot of people credit the Enlightenment for that. I think in some cases things like enlightened despotism, maybe with someone like Frederick the Great later on, reforms in the law that did away with the inquisitorial system of justice, did away with things like judicial torture. I think some of those things, but it depends where you are. I mean, in England... And I think this is significant. It's the same deal in Massachusetts in some ways. It's sort of the decline of Puritanism. You see this sort of taper out, too. So by the end of the 17th century, this seems to be a thing of the past, again, legally. That doesn't mean that people don't believe in these things. It's just there's nothing they can really do about it in terms of the law anymore.
Did they ever find out for sure if witches weigh more or less than a duck?
No, but... that's not that far from the truth. There was this thing they would do called the water test where you have a witch, so you hog tie her, and you throw her into the nearest body of water, and if she floats, well, that's bad because God's water has rejected her, hence a witch.
Huh.
If she sinks, that's good. God's water has accepted her, but she's hog tied in the middle of a river, so probably going to drown. You can't really win.
Yeah.
Rebecca.
And this is happening then in the early modern period still.
Oh, yeah. Rebecca Nurse, one of the things that got her convicted was they strip searched her. I mean, imagine an 80-year-old woman is being strip searched. And apparently, between her toes, two of her toes, they found some kind of growth, like a mole. Well, that was referred to at the time as a devil's teat. That's where the devil's familiar spirits would come and suckle from the witch. So if you were unlucky to have a sixth finger, if you were unlucky to have a prominent mole, that classic image of the witch, the hag, think of the Wizard of Oz with a big mole, that is part of that's the image of the time of how the devil's spirits communed with the witch. Because that's what a witch was, the devil's worshiper, the devil's servant.
Oh. Huh. Very interesting, and I don't want us to go too long. I think another episode, maybe sometime we can get you back in and maybe bring Professor Finnegan, too, would be...
Well, she could talk about Roman stuff, too.
Well, and I think the gender stuff as it plays in, why is this normally... why are women more prone to be
That's a big question, too, and, there's a big, it is mostly women, we should say that. So if I've said she when referring to witches, it's just a matter of of sort of the historical record.
Well, and you did mention earlier that it was mostly women before you began referring that way, and so I think the listener had that notion. But that is an interesting aspect of it. Aliva, any questions, comments before we begin to wrap things up?
Nope.
Have you ever thought about becoming a witch?
Nope.
May I see your toes?
Nope.
Aliva
is wearing Crocs. I just want to know, not sandals, so I can't see her toes as well as I would like to at this point. Go ahead, Peter.
I was going
to
ask, Aliva, have you now considered maybe being a witch or looking into it? Has Dr. Palmer encouraged you in a bad way?
Nope.
I actually had a student who was very concerned about this, about... how studying this would impact her spiritually. And I mean, I reassured her that we're studying witchcraft historically,
sure,
and not we're not studying. There's no lab component to
or
the course.
Or incantations.
No, I do want to have a lab component. I want to have a witch hunt on campus. We'll just pick some group of people who no one likes and persecute them for a semester. You know?
I think it usually works, too, if you do that.
Oh, yeah.
Just got to find someone no one likes.
Yeah, and just get everybody to turn against them. But, you know, certainly I...
You know, the odds are it would be one of us on the third floor, then.
Well, we're... Yeah, I mean...
Wade, you're getting
the land of misfit toys up here, but...
Yeah.
I mean, I would just urge people to, you know, historically... Study this as history. If you're getting into this in terms of modern occult stuff, there you want to exercise some caution, I think. This is not a light topic or something you want to enter into lightly.
Now, Aletha has recently gotten into the Harry Potter series, and so I'm wondering if she's maybe hiding some of her true desires here.
I like to play Quidditch.
Quidditch.
Now, I will say I've read all the Harry Potter books multiple times. I love the Harry Potter books. I'm a huge nerd. But I think it's totally ridiculous that some Christians will say, well, you can't read Harry Potter because it'll turn you into Satan worshiper. No, 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 it won't, actually.
Same here. What is that?
I think it's pietism. But
there we go. Yeah,
it rears its head.
You can't play Quidditch, but
you can't. Yeah, not yet. But we'll invent flying brooms one of these days.
And I've never read Harry Potter and don't know what Quidditch is, so I'm just gonna go ahead and be ignorant on that. I think a very helpful episode historically, and it, to kind of I think applications to our own day as well. Some we hit on, but others that I think are rather easily drawn. You know, sometimes you teach a class or you have a sermon or a Bible study and people say, well, what are the applications? And you just think, did you listen? Right? Like it shouldn't take much mental labor to make them. But I think very helpful in a number of applications that can be drawn as well. And so we thank Dr. Palmer for joining us. We didn't prepare Dr. Palmer for this, so we might be setting him up for failure here. You can't do worse than Dr. Brown on the first episode he was on when he just completely forgot and stared at me. But we will leave him in a moment to take us to our end. But as we live in a world that's still full of various tensions, wars, rumors of wars, political, economic, familial, plenty of stresses that are able to bring plenty of things to a flashpoint. And I think in a day when we're still hungry for people to blame or easy explanations, when it comes down to it, Dr. Palmer, what's the only thing we can do?
Let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to cry. I don't care what the people are thinking. I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set him up, another round. I set him up, another round. I set him up, another round. One more round won't get me down. And I said, honey, I don't care.